Good evening, and welcome to the Christian Science Monitor for Wednesday, February 12th. My name is Barbara Gehring. I am your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're going to start out with an article from World titled, Despite Shortage, Pope Against Married Men Becoming Priests. Pope Francis's decision against the ordination of married men relieved conservatives, disappointed progressives, and outraged women, who were also denied ordinance. In the Amazon, Catholics are left wondering how to continue to practice their faith. By Nicole Winfield, Associated Press. President Francis declined Wednesday to approve the ordination of married men to address a shortage of priests in the Amazon, sidestepping a fraught issue that has dominated debate in the Catholic Church and even involved retired Pope Benedict XVI. Francis, in an eagerly awaited document, did not refer to the recommendations by Amazonian bishops to consider the ordination of married men or women deacons. Rather, the Pope urged bishops to pray for more priestly vocations and to send missionaries to a region where faithful Catholics in remote areas can go months or even years without Mass. The papal dodge disappointed progressives, who had hoped he would, at the very least, put both questions to further study. It outraged liberal Catholic women's groups, and it relieved conservatives who have used the debate over priestly celibacy to heighten opposition to the Pope, whose strongest conservative critics have accused of heresy. Francis's document, Beloved Amazon, is instead a love letter to the Amazonian rainforest and its indigenous peoples, penned by history's first Latin American pope. Francis has long been concerned about the violent exploitation of the Amazon's land, its crucial importance to the global ecosystem, and the injustices committed against its people. Quoting poetry as frequently as past papal teachings, Francis addressed the document to all people of the world to help awaken their affection and concern for that land which is also ours, and to invite them to value it and acknowledge it as a sacred mystery. Beloved Amazon is in many ways a synthesized and focused version of Francis's 2015 landmark environmental encyclical, Praise Be, in which he blasted wealthy countries and multinational corporations for destroying the world's natural resources and impoverishing the poor for their own profit. Francis said he has four dreams for the Amazon: that the rights of the poor are respected, that their cultural riches are celebrated, that the Amazon's natural beauty and life are preserved, and that its Christian communities show Amazonian features. The Pope called for the Church to incorporate indigenous traditions and cultures into its ministry, including song and dance, myth, and festivals, and urge patience when confronted with apparently pagan practices and symbols. Francis had convened bishops from the Amazon's nine countries for a three-week meeting in October to debate the ways the Church can help preserve the delicate ecosystem from global warming and better minister to the region's people, many of whom live in isolated communities or in poverty in cities. The Argentine Jesuit has long been sensitive to the plight of the Amazon, where Protestant and Pentecostal churches are wooing away Catholic souls in the absence of vibrant Catholic communities where the Eucharist can be regularly celebrated. In their final document at the end of the October Synod, the majority of bishops called for the establishment of criteria so that respected married men in their communities who have already served as permanent deacons be ordained as priests. In addition, the bishops called for the Vatican to reopen a study, Commission on Ordaining Women as Deacons, a type of ministry in the Church that allows for preaching, celebrating weddings and baptisms, but not consecrating the Eucharist. Francis had created such a commission in 2016 at the insistence of religious sisters who want more say and roles in Church governance and ministry. But the group ended its work without reaching consensus. Francis didn't mention either proposal in Beloved Amazon and didn't cite the Synod's final document in his text or in a single footnote. But he did say in his introduction that he wanted to officially present the Synod's work and urged the faithful to read it in full, suggesting that he at least valued the input. The Pope did echo many of the Synod's recommendations, calling for greater lay participation in the life of the Church, and saying the training of priests in the Amazon must be overhauled so they are more able to minister to indigenous people. He said every effort should be made to give the faithful access to the Eucharist. This urgent need leads me to urge all bishops, especially those in Latin America, not only to promote prayer for priestly vocations, but also to be more generous in encouraging those who display a missionary vocation to opt for the Amazon region, he wrote. Francis dismissed suggestions that ordaining women to any ministry would serve them or the Church, while agreeing that women should have greater decision-making and governance roles. Francis argued that they must find other forms of service and charisms that are proper to women. Groups that advocate for women's ordination and giving women greater roles in the Catholic Church blasted the document. Francis justified his refusal to consider ordained ministry for women as sparing them the risk of being clericalized or placed on a pedestal. This is a dereliction of his duty as a leader with the power to make positive change and challenge discrimination, said Miriam Dwegan of the Wingards Institute for Catholic Research, a British-based progressive Catholic think tank. Kate McElwee, executive director of Women's Ordination Conference, said the document betrayed women in the Amazon and elsewhere who perform the lion's share of the Church's work, pass the faith from generation to generation, and yet enjoy no official recognition or authority. Recognizing women's work with diaconal ordination would be the first, most basic step toward righting the wrong of institutional sexism that hobbles our Church as it attempts to respond to the moral crises of our time, Ms. McElwee said in a statement. The Catholic Church retains the priesthood for men, arguing that Christ and his apostles were male. While Eastern Rite branches have married priests, and Anglican and Protestant priest converts can be married, the Roman Rite Church has had a tradition of priestly celibacy since the 11th century, imposed in part for financial reasons, to ensure that priests' assets pass to the Church, not to heirs. Our next article comes from USA. What does justice look like for presidents' friends and foes? There's a reason Lady Justice is portrayed as blind. The law is meant to apply equally. Moves this week by the Justice Department have raised concerns that department is no longer hewing to those ideals when it comes to friends and foes of the president. By Henry Gass, staff writer, and Patrick Johnson, staff writer. The events of this week are raising pointed questions about the rule of law and the political independence of America's largest law enforcement agency. On Tuesday, in an extraordinary move, the U.S. Department of Justice reduced its sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone, a conservative political consultant, after President Donald Trump tweeted his dismay at the previous recommendation federal prosecutors had made for his longtime confidant. By the end of the day, all four career DOJ prosecutors had withdrawn from the case, and one resigned entirely. The Justice Department is ostensibly an independent agency within the executive branch, but it has increasingly launched probes into the president's opponents and softened penalties for his allies since Attorney General William Barr became its leader last year. Those moves stand in opposition to the core principle of equal protection under the law, critics say, and threaten the integrity of America's judiciary. The Justice Department tends to be pretty aggressive with white-collar sentencing, and to have a sudden outbreak of moderation in the case of a guy who happens to be a crony of the president raises questions, says Frank Bowman, a professor at the University of Missouri School of Law. The minute the public begins to suspect that whether you are prosecuted or what your penalties end up being are affected by whether you are friends or enemies of the president, he adds, then a critical pillar of the American judicial system starts to crumble. Principles of punishment. Mr. Stone was convicted by a jury of obstructing Congress and witness tampering in November in a case related to the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. It was the final prosecution in Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation, an inquiry that Mr. Trump regularly criticized, which resulted in 7 guilty pleas and 2 convictions. His back tattoo of a smiling Richard Nixon encapsulates both Mr. Stone's political ideology and the approach he took for decades as a conservative political consultant. He has known Mr. Trump since the 1980s, and like other allies who have run afoul of the law, the president rallied to his defense. Prosecutors had recommended a tougher-than-normal sentence of 7 to 9 years in prison, which they wrote in a court filing would accurately reflect the seriousness of his crimes and promote respect for the rule of law. A sentencing recommendation is usually not a straightforward process. Prosecutors also take into account the offender's criminal history, age, and whether they chose to take the case to trial, something that typically results in harsher sentences if convicted. I have never seen a prosecutor go in and undermine a jury's verdict, says Laura Brevetti, a former Organized Crime Strike Force prosecutor with the DOJ. For offenses like Mr. Stone's, federal guidelines typically call for a sentence ranging from 15 to 21 months, though they can request more if the offender engages in additional questionable conduct. Before his trial, Mr. Stone posted on Instagram a photo of U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson, the trial judge, with crosshairs next to her head. During the trial, prosecutors wrote, he also appealed for a presidential pardon through the right-wing media. A senior DOJ official told media on Tuesday that the line prosecutor's recommendation was extreme and excessive and disproportionate to Stone's offenses. But the underlying principles of punishment are you want to deter people, says Kami Chavez, a professor at Wake Forest University's School of Law and a former U.S. attorney. We do want to deter people from lying to members of Congress. The fact that the 4 prosecutors involved have since left the case, she adds, suggests that they were uncomfortable with this high level of intervention that seems politically influenced. Sword and shield. Potential for abuse is rife in both a president's pardon power and their command of the executive branch. The fact that the Justice Department is part of the executive branch means there are 2 perpetual concerns, says Professor Bowman, author of High Crimes and Misdemeanors. One concern is that a president will use the DOJ as a shield to himself and his friends. The other is that they will use the DOJ as a sword against his enemies. This president has indicated a disposition to do both, he adds. The Stone case is not out of the blue. This is not some one-off event. 2 weeks ago, federal prosecutors backed off a recommendation of up to 6 months in prison for Michael Flynn, Mr. Trump's former national security advisor, who he has praised as a wonderful person and a very good man. Prosecutors now support probation for General Flynn, who pleaded guilty to lying to investigators in the Russia inquiry. The first pardon he granted was to Joe Arpaio, an early campaign supporter. The former sheriff of Arizona's Maricopa County was convicted of contempt of court for disobeying a federal judge's order to stop racially profiling Latinos. Prosecutors oppose requests for early release for Michael Cohen, the president's longtime personal attorney who cooperated with the Mueller investigation before pleading guilty to tax fraud and lying charges. Days after being acquitted by the U.S. Senate, Mr. Trump fired two key witnesses against him during the House impeachment inquiry, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, an Iraq War veteran on the National Security Council staff, and Gordon Sondland, the former U.S. ambassador to the European Union. Mr. Vindman's twin brother, who also was assigned to the NSC, was also removed. Jesse Liu, a federal prosecutor who led the Stone case, had her nomination for a post at the Treasury Department abruptly pulled this week by the White House. "We all know what Trump is about, and we all know what he is doing," says Ms. Brevetti. The Stone sentence brings up the issue of whether or not, at the highest levels of the Justice Department, is integrity no longer the coin of the realm? Barr's Justice Department. When former Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from any investigation into the 2016 election in which he'd campaigned for Mr. Trump, the president lambasted him for it. After months of public criticism on Twitter, Mr. Sessions resigned in November 2018. His replacement, Mr. Barr, has appeared more responsive to the president's interests. Mr. Barr returned to the DOJ with a track record of supporting broad presidential power and immunity from investigation. Since taking office, he has opened a review of the Mueller investigation and fired FBI Director James Comey's actions. He has also opened an intake process to vet material that Rudy Giuliani, Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, has gathered in Ukraine on former Vice President Joe Biden, who is seeking the Democratic nomination. On Wednesday, the president congratulated Mr. Barr for taking charge of a case that was totally out of control. Also on Wednesday, Mr. Barr agreed to testify before the House Judiciary Committee, ending a year-long standoff. Ultimately, Judge Jackson will still make the decision as to how Mr. Stone is punished. But these events have significantly damaged the Justice Department's credibility, says Rebecca Roife, a professor at New York Law School and an expert on judicial ethics. "The president and Mr. Barr are convinced that we have a deep state, including our Department of Justice," she adds, refuting the idea that the DOJ is full of progressives who are trying to undermine the White House. "Those aren't the kinds of people who go into law enforcement. People who choose to be federal prosecutors are not left-wing crazies." It's not the end of the world, but I do think that the credibility of the Department of Justice as a non-political body that enforces the law equally against all is in jeopardy, she continues. "This is not damage that can easily be constrained to Trump. Once this line is crossed, it's really hard to go back." Next, we have an article titled, "After New Hampshire, Minority Voters Could Reshape Democratic Race." After Iowa and New Hampshire, candidates head to states where they have to appeal to a more racially diverse group of voters. By Krista Case Bryant, staff writer, and Story Hinckley, staff writer. It may have gone more smoothly than Iowa, but Tuesday's New Hampshire primary did little to resolve the Democratic presidential nomination contest, and indeed may have increased the likelihood of a long, protracted battle that could go all the way to the convention. Winner Bernie Sanders and runner-up Pete Buttigieg, who narrowly leads the overall delegate count coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire, can both plausibly claim some form of front-runner status, though neither looks particularly formidable. Amy Klobuchar, who until recently was languishing in the single digits, is hoping to capitalize on an unexpectedly strong third-place finish. With Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden placing a distant fourth and fifth and amassing no delegates in New Hampshire, a feeling of doom surrounds their campaigns. But as the Biden campaign is urgently emphasizing, 99.9% of African-American Democratic primary voters and 99.8% of Latino Democratic primary voters have not yet weighed in. As the contest moves to Nevada and South Carolina, the very different electorates there could change the shape of the race substantially yet again, potentially giving new life to candidates like former Vice President Biden and Senator Warren, who have built diverse coalitions of support. I don't think African American voters in South Carolina or Super Tuesday states give two flying kites what the early contest outcomes are, says Antoine Seawright, a Democratic strategist in South Carolina. Candidates that are coming into South Carolina and Super Tuesday who do not have relationships or have not gained the trust of the political concrete of this party, black voters, they're going to be drinking hot soda out of a cup. It's not going to taste good. Indeed, Nevada and South Carolina could muddle the Democratic field even further at a time when party elites are increasingly worried about the prospects of beating President Donald Trump in November. Some see a strong possibility of a contested Democratic convention in July, which could force the party to choose between a fired-up progressive wing and a larger pragmatic wing that retains deep-seated skepticism about the prospect of a ticket headed by Senator Sanders, a Democratic socialist. If Sanders goes to the convention with a plurality of delegates but not a majority, would they deny him the nomination? Asked Dante Scala, a political scientist at the University of New Hampshire in Durham. It would be a high-risk maneuver that would take some steel on the spines of party elites and superdelegates. We'll see if they're so super. The beneficiary of all this may well be former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a billionaire whose unorthodox strategy of skipping the early states appears increasingly viable and who is polling well among black voters nationally. Sanders wins the primary, but in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a cold, misty rain was falling as voters headed to the polls on Tuesday. Outside the new Franklin School in Ward 1, a young volunteer holding a big Pete sign and an older woman displaying Amy Klobuchar for All of America stood on opposite sides of the sidewalk, joking with each other and engaging in small talk. As a woman emerged from the polling site, she looked at both of them and pushed her hands together as if to mime, "You should be on the same ticket." Indeed, the combined vote tallies of Mr. Buttigieg, the Wunderkind, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and Senator Klobuchar of Minnesota, ranked the most effective Democratic senator in Congress, would have beaten Senator Sanders by double digits in New Hampshire. Yet the first two primary states haven't revealed much about what the Democratic electorate wants, says Theodore R. Johnson, a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York, and an expert on the role of race in electoral politics. We've only learned about what more progressive white primary voters in two states want, he says. Still, a YouGov poll from late January found that black voters were nearly twice as likely as white voters to base their vote on candidates' performance in the Iowa caucuses. If you're a pragmatic voter, which I argue is the dominant tendency among black voters, then you are looking to see who wins primaries because they bring with them the air of electability, says Dr. Johnson, who adds that black voters are getting a little skittish in their support for Mr. Biden. But Mr. Seawright, who says that African-American voters understand their political net worth and have always been independent-minded, says that South Carolina is still Mr. Biden's to lose. He adds, the second and third place contestants will have an opportunity to drive a specific narrative that could help them gain momentum as they prepare to face Michael Bloomberg and his resources on Super Tuesday. Mr. Buttigieg, a prolific fundraiser who has taken flack from other candidates for embracing wealthy donors, has gained momentum from his strong performances in the first two states. But the true reach of his candidacy will be much clearer after Nevada and South Carolina. According to a Quinnipiac poll taken after the Iowa caucus, Mr. Buttigieg is polling at 4% with African Americans nationally. Senator Klobuchar is at 0%. Mr. Biden, by comparison, retained 27% support despite a disappointing showing in Iowa. Mr. Bloomberg registered at 22%, and Sanders at 19% among Black Americans. And Tom Steyer, though not registering with Black voters nationally, has gained double-digit support among African Americans in South Carolina, where he has been investing heavily. In Nevada, which holds its caucuses a week from Saturday, and where about 20% of eligible voters are Latino, 538's average of the most highly rated polls had Senator Sanders leading at 24.2%, followed by Mr. Biden in second with almost 19%, then Senator Warren and Mr. Buttigieg with 12% and 9%, respectively. But just as South Carolina polls shifted after Iowa, the first two contests are likely to affect the polling in Nevada as well. To succeed in Nevada, the Buttigieg campaign says they are working to persuade the state's Latino voters by translating campaign material into Spanish, opening a field office in the heavily Latino neighborhood of East Las Vegas, and launching radio ads with Mr. Buttigieg himself speaking in Spanish. All of the presidential candidates are now white, after Andrew Yang and Deval Patrick dropped out of the race last night, despite an initial field that was far more racially diverse. Possibility of a contested convention. Boosting Black turnout, which dipped in 2016, is seen as crucial to a Democratic victory in November. The Center for American Progress found that a return to 2012 levels, in addition to natural demographic trends, would enable the party to win the three states vital to Mr. Trump's victory: Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. But, of course, race is only one factor in Democrats' decision about which candidate will garner strong support. Ideally, they also want someone popular among progressives, urbanites, and working-class voters, as well as Black Democrats, groups that sometimes overlap and sometimes don't. Finding one individual who can speak to those sometimes disparate interests may prove more difficult than Barack Obama made it appear. The growing concern, therefore, is that by the time delegates descend on Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for the Democratic National Convention in July, no one candidate will have gained majority support. That could open the way for a brokered convention. If no candidate got a majority of votes on the first round, a second round of voting with input from superdelegates could well produce a different candidate, angering many, says Don Fowler, a former DNC chair from South Carolina who has been involved in Democratic politics for more than 50 years. And that, he says, would create a great, great crisis to the party. Before we move on to our next story, let's pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Barbara Gehring. I'm your volunteer reader. Moving on, our next article is titled, "Palestinians Protest Trump Plan at UN, But Has World Moved On?" At the UN, Palestinians found that reservations about the U.S. peace plan do not now translate into a willingness to oppose President Trump. By Howard LaFranchi, staff writer. For decades, the international community has largely deferred to the United States' lead in the effort to bring peace to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Think President Jimmy Carter's Camp David Accords, the President Bill Clinton parameters, and President George W. Bush's Annapolis Peace Conference. But now that President Donald Trump has unveiled his long-awaited deal of the century that aims to resolve the conflict once and for all, the global response looks different. Gone is the broad acceptance of the U.S. lead and the near-uniform lining up of the international community behind U.S. efforts at Mideast peace. but also gone, is a fervent dedication to the Palestinian cause as a top international priority, particularly among Arab countries. At the same time, the weight and influence of the U.S. in the region and the world remains such that no peace initiative from an American president is going to be summarily dismissed. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas learned this Tuesday at the United Nations in New York, where he had hoped to culminate an appearance before the Security Council, in which he blasted the Trump peace plan as one-sided and unfair, with a resolution demonstrating global rejection of the plan. This is an Israeli-American preemptive plan in order to put an end to the question of Palestine, Mr. Abbas told the council. The Trump plan is like Swiss cheese, really, the Palestinian leader added, holding aloft a map of the series of small islands within Israeli territory that would constitute a Palestinian entity under the American proposal. Who among you will accept a similar state and conditions? And indeed, all of the Council's 15 members, 5 permanent members, and 10 rotating seats, except for the U.S., expressed reservations about the Trump peace plan, with most members saying they remain committed to a negotiated settlement that results in a viable Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. Still, things did not go as Mr. Abbas had hoped. Once it became clear that a resolution intended to underscore American isolation over the Trump peace plan was garnering only mixed support, the resolution was first watered down and then delayed indefinitely as resolution sponsors Tunisia and Indonesia scrambled to try to secure support. Already a hint at this lingering global reluctance to stand in opposition to an American Mideast initiative and to risk drawing the ire of the peace plan's namesake had come last week. Tunisia's well-respected UN ambassador, who helped fashion a resolution that was sharply critical of the U.S. peace plan, but who also linked that criticism to the U.S. president, was abruptly sacked. Tunisia's ambassador to the United Nations has been dismissed for purely professional reasons concerning his performance and lack of coordination with the ministry on important matters under discussion at the UN, the Tunisian foreign ministry said in a statement. But diplomatic sources at the UN said that, in fact, the ambassador, Monsef Badi, had been fired because the resolution he spearheaded had specifically criticized the Trump peace plan as being in violation of international law. Tunisia has a new president, Kais Saied, who did not want to start his tenure facing the wrath of the U.S. president, sources added. 3 years into the Trump presidency, a widespread international understanding of what getting on the U.S. president's wrong side can mean played some role in the Security Council's reluctance to go on record condemning the U.S. plan, some analysts say. Trump's reputation as a counterpuncher really has deterred many actions that could provoke him to take negative or retaliatory steps, says James Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. I'd say the Tunisian decision on its ambassador probably reflected that. Still, Mr. Phillips and others say what the lack of fiery support for Mr. Abbas reflects, first and foremost, is the waning of international interest in the Palestinian cause. It's sad for the Palestinians, but they just aren't the do-or-die issue for countries that they once were, says Michael Oppenheimer, a professor of U.S. foreign policy and international relations at New York University's Center for Global Affairs. Clearly, this issue has become kind of a nuisance for many countries, particularly the Gulf states that once stood solidly behind them, he adds. It's no longer central to their diplomacy or to their pursuit of national interests. Other priorities, from tending to broad strategic relationships with the U.S. and even Israel, to confronting an expansive Iran, have supplanted the Palestinian issue at the core of Arab and Gulf countries' interests, Professor Oppenheimer says. At the same time, Heritage's Mr. Phillips says many countries look at other challenges in the region, the Syrian civil war with its millions of refugees, the war in Yemen, upheaval in Libya, the destabilizing presence of the Islamic State, and the result has been a weakening fervor for the Palestinian cause. The impact of all these other conflicts is that the Palestinians' plight is not perceived to be as bad as it used to be, he says. U.S. officials say privately that this week's Security Council session on the Trump plan for resolving the conflict turned out better than they might have expected. They note, for example, that the Council had voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution condemning the Trump administration's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital in 2017, forcing the U.S. to veto the measure. By comparison, they take the failure of a resolution condemning the Trump plan as a victory and a sign of things going in the direction of the Trump vision. Still, NYU's Professor Oppenheimer says that does not mean the world likes what it sees in Mr. Trump's deal of the century. Clearly, this is not a peace plan. Let's not pretend that it is. It's a reflection of facts on the ground, he adds. The kind of treaty you'd expect at the end of a war with a clear winner and loser. Many countries in the region and in Europe may not like that reality, Professor Oppenheimer says, but they have moved on to other priorities and interests. Any opposition we hear now, such as that voiced at Tuesday's Security Council session, is lip service, he says. But frankly, I think it's been lip service all along. Okay, now we'll move on to an article from Commentary titled, Politics of Hate Loses a Key Vote in India. Voters in the nation's capital sent a message to the ruling party that anti-Muslim policies go against India's secular tradition by the Monitor's editorial board. The Muslim majority in the world's two most populous countries, China and India, have lately felt very much under siege. Since 2017, China has shut mosques and rounded up its Uyghur Muslims for mass re-education. In December, India passed a new citizenship law for migrants that purposely excludes Muslims. It was the first time that religion has been used to grant nationality, despite India's secular constitution. In other moves, the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, has signaled it seeks a Hindu-centric nation. In each country, the anti-Muslim discrimination differs in scope and intensity. Yet one difference stands out. In India, which is the world's largest democracy, both Muslims and non-Muslims have held sustained protests for 2 months against the new citizenship law, the largest demonstrations in decades. Even more important, voters appear to be in revolt. On February 8th, the BJP suffered a massive defeat in local elections in New Delhi, despite intense campaigning by the party's leader, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. With 20 million people, the nation's capital is a microcosm of the country. The BJP won only 8 of 70 seats in the city's assembly, while the other seats went to the local Aam Aadmi Party, Common Man's Party, or AAP. Its leader, Arvind Kejriwal, is a well-known anti-corruption activist who, as Delhi's chief minister since 2013, has implemented popular anti-poverty projects. He opposes any fear-mongering against Muslims. One of the AAP's top leaders, Sanjay Singh, said the election result is a mandate against hate. Mr. Kejriwal says the vote is a victory for Mother India, for our entire country. Indeed, the election was seen as a referendum on Mr. Modi's politics of division and his image as protector of Hindus, who are about 80% of the population. The resistance against the BJP's policies could go on. Even though the party won national elections last May, it has lost power in five states since 2018 and may lose more this year. In a democracy, where the principle of equality for all people before the law is sacred, the use of hatred to win votes or to hold power is easily exposed. Our next article is from Culture. It's titled, "Is Another Version of Austin's Emma Worth Your Time?" Yes. Autumn de Wilde's engaging adaptation of Austin's Emma honors love's dizzying permutations, joining the ranks of memorable romantic movies. By Peter Rainier, film critic. How fitting that a new movie version of Jane Austen's Emma should appear around Valentine's Day. I don't mean to trivialize Austen, whose comprehension of the human comedy went far beyond greeting card platitudes, but she might well have approved of the timing, if only because Emma is one of her most ardent tributes to love's dizzying permutations. Directed by Autumn de Wilde in her feature debut and scripted by Man Booker Prize winner Eleanor Catton, this latest movie adaptation sustains a consistent note of measured mirth. As in the novel, the romantic flippancies have a serious core because its stake is nothing less than the prospect of an enduring happiness. Spoiled, vain 21-year-old Emma Woodhouse, Anya Taylor-Joy, who adores her doddering father, Bill Nighy, fancies herself a matchmaker, and so she intrudes to often disastrous effect in the lives of those she most dotes upon. She single-handedly persuades her meek protege Harriet, Mia Goth, to spurn the welcome proposal of a lovesick farmer in the expectation that a finer catch, the fatuous Reverend Elton, Josh O'Connor, will come through. But Elton, to Emma's astonished dismay, has eyes only for Emma, and so it goes. When the equally fine 1996 adaptation of Austen's novel starring Gwyneth Paltrow came out, I wrote that, despite her impositions, to reject Emma is to reject a large measure of our own blundering selves, the part for which we perhaps have the tenderest feelings. Emma exists as a force of nature, and since we recognize so much of her nature in ourselves, our response to her has a solicitous, protective quality. We are placed in the position of her several suitors. We want to see her happy. It's to De Wilde and Catton's credit that this aspect of the novel comes through undiminished. There have been many other respectable Emma adaptations, including several for British TV, but I am most fond of Amy Heckerling's savvy Clueless, with Alicia Silverstone as Cher, a Beverly Hills Emma adrift in the malls. My favorites among the scores of other Austen movies, not the least because they best capture the Austen spirit, are Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility, scripted by and starring Emma Thompson, the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, with Keira Knightley as a touching, scrappy Elizabeth Bennet, the 1995 BBC version featuring Colin Firth, the thinking woman's hunk as Mr. Darcy, and the 1940 version, co-written by Aldous Huxley, with Laurence Olivier in full syllable-splitting mode as Darcy. The ad line for that film, "When pretty girls teased men into marriage," is a promo I am fairly sure Austen would not have approved of. One of the pleasures of the new Emma is, let's face it, its retroness. With modern gender dynamics in perpetual divisive flux, the old rules for making movie romances no longer have quite the same sway. This flux presents a necessary challenge for a new generation of filmmakers who have come up through the hashtag MeToo era, a challenge that, for the most part, has yet to be met. It's perhaps no accident that the most acclaimed coupling in contemporary movies is not between humans. It's between Sally Hawkins' cleaning lady and the fish gill creature in the shape of water. Many of the more memorable recent romantic movies are set not in the incendiary present, but in the past, such as Little Women, particularly the scenes between Saoirse Ronan and Timothée Chalamet, or La La Land, which takes place in a swoony present that is made to seem like the past, or A Star is Born, which revamps an oft-remade warhorse. I can't think of a more piercing romantic film in recent years than Brooklyn, set in the 1950s, with Ronan as a homesick Irish immigrant attempting to reconcile the confusions of her ardor. The intricacies of romantic emotion reside in these films. The new Emma joins their company. Jane Austen speaks to us as clearly now as she did some 200 years ago. Maybe what is retro isn't so retro after all. Our next article is titled The Game We Played. My father and I both knew what was really going on when I got him to shoot hoops. It wasn't really about basketball. It was about the connection. By Robert McGee, contributor. My mother always said that my father could fix anything except a broken heart. She may have misjudged. Born in Texas at the start of the Great Depression, with a deformed right arm, he couldn't raise past his ear. My father compensated for his inability to play games or go to war by channeling his immense energy into building houses and repairing things. As you can imagine, he wasn't thrilled when I became obsessed with sports involving balls. I often had to walk 5 miles to Little League when I was 12, and in the dozens of football games I played in high school, my father attended just one. The lone exception to my father's aversion to sports was that sometimes I could get him to play the basketball shooting game of horse. I wasn't much of a basketball player, but on our lopsided goal, which was 3 inches low and sloped slightly south, I was unstoppable. I could sink the most amazing turnaround jumpers from 18 feet away. My father, with only one good arm, had just one decent shot in his arsenal, a long winding left hook that would either bank in with great authority or sail into my mother's petunias. I could beat my father at will, and in just 5 shots, if I took 5 fadeaway jumpers from the south side of the rim. But I loved playing with him so much that I'd con my father into another game, and another, by allowing him to keep the games close. "You have to win by 2 letters," I would claim the moment he edged ahead. "This game might never end," he would groan, as I nodded the score. "Maybe not," I would laugh. Then I'd clank an ill-advised runner off the north side of the rim, which would lead my father to accuse me of throwing the game, to which I'd respond with a shrug. Sometimes I did lose on purpose. Those times, before my father could return to his work, I would quickly shout, "Rematch!" Only by missing on purpose, and so, risking defeat, could I force my father to take the breaks I was sure he needed. Occasionally, I'd make wagers I knew he wouldn't refuse. "I'll clean out the barn if you win. I'll split a cord of wood. I won't ask you to play again for 1 year." Only by offering such enticements could I fool my father into believing I was a man of honor and, somewhat dishonorably, lure him into my trap. And if my father lost, well, he would simply have to play 1 more game with his son. In these ways, our private series continued for weeks, months, and years. Our battles were living things, ever evolving. These contests went on much longer than my father likely anticipated or claimed he wished to play. Though he would never admit it, I know he enjoyed these interruptions from his toil and worry. My parents were under constant financial strain for most of my childhood, often on the brink of foreclosure. Their late-night conversations seeped through my bedroom wall, carrying sadness and stress. But my father seemed to forget his troubles for a time while we shot hoops on our farm in the middle of nowhere, even after my mother had called us a third time for dinner, even after it was too dark to see. A quarter century after my father's death and the sale of that farm, we are out there still, on land I am forever to own in my mind. In my midlife memory, my father and I rattle the most beautiful baskets, while I am gifted with not only pain grimaces, but also a fair amount of sly grinning that accompanies the willingness of a one-armed man to be duped. And despite my late mother's claim, it's this memory of my father that fixes me now. Our last article today comes from Books, titled The 10 Best Books of February 2020. Our picks include a novel about two fathers in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a tale of a rogue naturalist, and a biography of Emily Dickinson by Monitor Reviewers. Number 1, A Paragon by Colm McCann. Colm McCann's novel is a meditation on Israel, geographically, politically, and psychologically, as told through the story of an Israeli and a Palestinian. The two men each lost a daughter to the conflict. Grief has sealed their friendship and hardened their conviction of the need to end the occupation. Number 2, Love Unscripted by Owen Nichols. A romantic comedy, this debut novel follows a film projectionist as he comes to terms with the fact that romance in real life bears little resemblance to what's in the movies. Film references abound as he and his girlfriend struggle through disillusionment before arriving at a charming, happy ending. Number 3, Amnesty by Aravind Adiga. A Sri Lankan man living as an unauthorized immigrant in Australia discovers that he holds key information in a murder case. But if he goes to the authorities to reveal the killer, he will also reveal himself. Aravind Adiga unfolds a compelling story that pits self-interest against conscience. Number 4, The Authenticity Project by Claire Pooley. When Monica, a London cafe owner, discovers a notebook with an entry written by an eccentric artist seeking to be truthful, she sets off a chain reaction of transformation when she commits to helping him. More entries follow, strangers become friends, and a community blossoms. Claire Pooley's novel is fresh, funny, and inspirational. Number 5, Bird Summons by Laila Abuela. Three Muslim women set off on a pilgrimage in Scotland in Laila Abuela's novel. Salma, who married a Scot, misses her Egyptian home and childhood sweetheart. Mani has subsumed her life to care for her ill son. Ayman, who's been dumped by her third husband, is homeless. Abuela does a beautiful job examining faith and the interior life of women. There's a thread of magic realism that unfortunately snags the plot as the book goes on, but it is impossible not to root for the trio to find their way. Number 6, The Adventurer's Son by Roman Dial. Renowned biologist and explorer Roman Dial searches for his 27-year-old son, who has gone missing in the jungles of Costa Rica. Part memoir, part mystery, The Adventurer's Son is a story of a father's love for his son and for the natural world. Number 7, 1774 by Mary Beth Norton. Cornell University history professor Mary Beth Norton has crafted a deeply researched and beautifully written account of the year in which the forces pushing the American colonies to rebellion finally came to the boiling point. Number 8, The Falcon Thief by Joshua Hammer. In the tradition of Susan Orleans, the orchid thief, Joshua Hammer chronicles another naturalist gone rogue. The falcon thief tells of an enterprising rustler of falcon eggs, which are prized among those who want to hatch them as expensive pets. It's a gripping read, a tale of obsession that promises to engross readers as they wonder, with each turn of the page, what will happen next. Number 9, These Fevered Days by Martha Ackman. This engaging biography of poet Emily Dickinson focuses on 10 pivotal episodes that shaped her life and poems. Martha Ackman describes these with the flair of a novelist, drawing on research and insights she gleaned from teaching a Dickinson seminar at Mount Holyoke College. Ackman challenges stereotypes about the poet and provides a rich sense of how the woman in white may have experienced her world. Number 10, The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. Eric Larson, who's been thrilling readers for decades as one of America's best popular historians, turns his attention to Britain during World War II. In The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz, Larson expertly captures not only a nation's despair, but also the extraordinary human responses to the crisis, from courage and ingenuity to passion and grit. We've reached the end of our program, the Christian Science Monitor for Wednesday, February 12, 2020. I'm Barbara Gehring, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please remember, if you missed your favorite program, you can find it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org. Then click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thanks for listening. Good night.